because the old plan, the model was, hey, get out of school, start a nice practice, put some money aside in the 401k profit sharing plan, something like that, build a nice practice. And by the time you're ready to retire and get out of the chair, you'll be able to sell that practice. And then that combined with the investments that you have on the side will be plenty to cover your current lifestyle. And what we're finding is that that's not really true.
You're listening to the Dental Sherpas podcast, where we make it easier to transform your practice, get out of the chair, and into the life you want.
Well, welcome back, everybody, back to the Dental Sherpas podcast. We've got a great episode for you today. Good to see you, Sid. How are things with you today?
Oh, good to see you too, Matt. Things are rainy, but they're still wonderful because I'm still living in Hawaii.
Raining in Hawaii. That's right. That's, you know, a soft problem, right?
Well, yeah. One no one wants to hear about, right?
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, you got some exciting stuff going on in your dental practice that I'm sure we'll share later on in the podcast. So that's exciting. And we've got some exciting things going on here with the podcast. Our website is out by the time this airs, dentalsherpaspod.com, and we're going to have some resources there for you as well. Dr. Lewis's book is at the final stages, about to come out. And then also, I've got a new book coming out, said, called Dental Practice Built Right. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the concepts in it today as well. So we got lots of stuff going on here, but let's dive into our topic today, if that's okay. And what I want to talk about today, what we want to talk about today is what we're seeing in the dental world. You know, I talk to folks every day, especially from the financial advising side of the business. And what I find is that folks are in a real dilemma. And if you're okay with it, I want to describe that dilemma here for just a second. The dilemma really is that, you know, I find dentists all the time that are 50, 55 years old, something like that. Their bodies are starting to break down sometimes. They're maybe for other reasons, they're just kind of ready to start thinking about getting out of the chair, how they can get out of the chair. And they start looking at maybe selling their practice, right? Because the old plan, the model was, hey, get out of school, start a nice practice, put some money aside in the 401k profit sharing plan, something like that, build a nice practice. And by the time you're ready to retire and get out of the chair, you'll be able to sell that practice. And then that combined with the investments that you have on the side will be plenty to cover your current lifestyle. And what we're finding is that that's not really true. And one of the reasons it's not true is because, you know, let's be honest, dentistry, when you're in the chair, can be, if done well, can be really profitable. Right, Ted? And so if you're, let's say you're producing $1 million a year, you might be bringing home $300,000 or $400,000 a year. Well, how big does an asset base need to be? How big does your pile of money have to be? I ask dentists all the time to be able to stop your work and then draw income off of this big pile of money over there and replace that $300,000 or $400,000 a year income. It has to be really, really high. You know, the financial planning, and some people say, there's some articles out there about the 4% rule, meaning if you retire, you need to withdraw 4% off your assets. Well, how big does that asset pile need to be able to draw off 4%? It has to be really, really big. And what we're finding is that dental practices, we'll talk about this, dental practices aren't selling for what they had hoped, doctors can hope. And it's almost impossible to save enough and invest enough to have just a pile of money up there that throws off interest to replace their current lifestyle. So they're squarely in, forgive the long introduction here, but they're squarely in what I like to call the can't save enough, can't sell for enough dilemma, right? And so I find these folks all the time, and they're looking for ways out. So one of the ways out is, well, let's just deal with the obvious. The number one thing that I hear all the time said, tell me if you hear this, the number one thing I hear all the time when I ask the question, hey, what's your exit strategy? How are you going to get out of the chair at some point? The number one thing I hear is, well, I'll never get out of the chair.
Yeah,
I'll probably just die in that chair doing dental work.
Right. Yeah. I hear that really quite a bit too of late. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of where the state of our industry has got to with many people. And I think that's the challenge that I see with a lot of dentists out there, is because they've identified, so to the point of the dentist, they've identified what you just said, is that they look at the reality that when they're in the chair and when they're working, they're highly profitable. But then they look at the idea that picture they thought they would save, maybe, you know, I remember, like, they told me in dental school, you save $2 million, right? You put that away, you have a nice 401k, you sell the practice for a little bit of money, and then you can live on that for the rest of your life. And you realize, if you break that down, when you really grind the numbers down, that comes down to basically like $35,000 a year if you start doing it out for the rest. Because none of us, I mean, let's be honest, I mean, most of us are going to live a lot longer lives than our parents did, and a lot longer than the people did when they actually made those particular algorithms out. And so that's the one kind of tangible thing that we have to come to understanding with. And to the point, like Matt just said, I think now dentists are seeing that. And that's the sad state of affairs, where most people are saying, yeah, I'm just going to work until I can't work no more.
So that's really sad. And honestly, that's my mission these days, is to try to help doctors make sure that that's not the case for them. Mm-hmm. So if option one, we're all agreeing here on the Dental Sherpas podcast, option one is not a great option. So let's talk about some other options. So let's talk for a second. I'd love for you to briefly describe or discuss some different ways that a doctor might sell his or her practice. There's a lot of different models out there.
Right. There's a lot of different models. I think what most people who are thinking about, or at least have heard in the past, this used to be the model of choice as early as just a few years ago, where you would sell the value of your practice for about 70-80% of the last 3 years' average revenue. That used to be the kind of the benchmark that banks would use to kind of set up lending for it, or actually what the brokers would put together. But now it seems to be everyone is essentially selling their practice now, when you have brokers coming into play, especially when it comes down to larger buyers. They're typically basically doing a multiple of something called EBITDA. And I'm not going to go into the whole detail of what EBITDA is, but think of it, it's kind of like after you paid all your expenses out, what you're left over with. So whatever your annual nut is, that's basically, they're going to do a multiple off of that. So nowadays, what happens is they're going to be selling, the typical practice is being sold four times that multiple. So that's kind of a very, for lack of a better term, you know, riveting information for a lot of people. Some people think, well, I'll just keep banging up that number, that productivity, not worrying about the expenses. But the reality is, like I was saying, they're basically going to be paying you off whatever you're taking home now in a multiple of that, not what the practice production or collection, total collection or gross collections would be. So that's typically, you know, what if you're a solo practitioner. So long and the short of it, that's what you can delve into if you're going to be selling your practice.
Instead, let me make sure that folks understand those numbers. That EBITDA number is after the owner doctor gets paid. It's what's left over.
Correct. The way they look at it is basically, it's not so much what the doctor is, for lack of a better term, they expect the doctor to be taking out and getting paid. It's literally what the actual real profit is.
So it's after the doctor gets paid. This is really the true profit number. So let's take a $1 million producing practice after the doctor gets paid. And let's say they're doing really, really good, and they're maybe getting 15 to 20% profit left over, right? So they've got, let's say, $200,000 in EBITDA, and you're saying that what they're getting offered is times four, right?
Times four, correct.
That's right.
So for a typical solo practice, right.
So you got an $800,000 purchase price on someone who's usually, you know, probably in that situation making between 400, maybe even 450 to 500,000 a year, but once they get paid like an associate, right? Cool. So that's what I'm saying. Doctors are doing the math and they're going, wait a second. I'm used to living on 400,000. I'm going to get 800,000. Now, why is that? Why are those offers so, you know, low?
Well, I think the reality is, this is the thing that the dentists have to come to grips with, is that you're literally, what these people who are buying the practice, they're buying a business. They're not buying you, right? And so the reality is that dentists need to understand this, is that you don't come with the practice. If they're going to buy it, they're only going to be getting the practice. So long story short, that's what the biggest challenge for dentists to understand, is that you're not going to be getting a value as if you're going to still be churning out all that dentistry you're currently doing while sitting in the chair. And so long and the short of it is that they're simply buying the value at a practice at a number that makes sense to them and what's left for them to actually make money on once you're out of the picture.
That's right. It's a major issue that doctors run into. We call it in our process, we call it a hub and spoke problem, that everything runs through the main doctor and all the production runs through the main doctor. And as soon as they sell that practice, the investor or the buyer knows that they're walking out the door. And so that investor either has to replace that doctor with themselves, right? So I'm the doctor and I come in and buy, and I replace the doctor by sitting down in the chair and doing the work myself, or I've got to pay another doctor, you know, what that original owner doctor was making in order for them to do the work, right? So all of the skill, all of the work goes out the window when that owner doctor goes out. And so what that actually ends up doing is, it's interesting, we talk about this in this new book that I have coming up. It's one of the principles that we talk about. What that actually ends up doing is it devalues the practice, right? So the more that owner doctor is in that practice, the less value, really. It's almost a kind of a pendulum there. The more they're in there, the less value. So let's talk about then the DSO, right? Why the rise of, you know, kind of out of all of this, out of doctors trying to figure out how to sell, right? And yeah, some of those old models that we've seen, right, is sell to an associate, right? Or maybe even bring in a partner. And, you know, I've seen it structured where there's a 65-year-old doctor who has a, you know, 45-year-old partner, and then they have a 25-year-old associate, right? Yeah. And so they've kind of built in this ladder, you know, system where, hey, you're going to buy from this guy and you're going to buy from this guy. The younger guys end up buying from the older guys. But then what's come up out of that is now the rise of this thing called the DSO, or the Dental Service Organization. Talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, so I think I'm sure most people by now heard of the DSO. I mean, the big moniker obviously is like, you know, they're like the big brother, right? They're the guys who come into your neighborhood and they've got a large clinic and they've got a lot of associate doctors working there. And essentially they have employee doctors, and sometimes there's minority owner doctors. But essentially what they do is they come in there and they, for lack of a better term, create a practice which is based on what's really going on in the world right now. The reason it's got so popular, here's where you have to really listen up, guys. The things have changed dramatically for the associate doctors coming out of school, right? And it comes down to the realities of how much money they owe on their student loans. The typical associate doctor coming out of dental school nationwide is literally in the hole $250,000 when they come out of, to actually start practicing.
Yeah.
That means that that money that typically would have gone toward buying your practice is being set for debt service to pay off all their student loans. So many of them, the majority of them, don't see themselves coming out and becoming an active buyer to buy people's practices anymore. So it's really kind of allowed the DSOs to really strengthen their grip on the market, because now what they realize is that, okay, we're going to dominate the ability to basically hire a lot of these doctors, because a lot of these doctors don't want to have practices, right? And they're changing the market, the dental practice market, because now rather than these associate doctors buying the practice, you have now these larger groups who are going in there and subsequently buying dental practices now. So that becomes the new market now. So the DSO now becomes both the giant recruiter of dentists, of talent, and now they also become the biggest player in the buyer's market for buying dental practices.
So
when you look at it that way, that now becomes the scenario of how the dental practice landscape has changed dramatically in the last several years, and subsequently why, in many cases, how dental practice ownership has become fragmented because of that.
Yeah. You know, I think too, when I talk to dentists around the country, you know, one of their biggest gripes, I guess is maybe the right word, or one of their biggest laments, we'll call it that, is that they go, gosh, you know, when I was in dental school, I just thought I was going to come out and be a dentist. And now I've got all these management responsibilities and these business responsibilities and all that kind of stuff. And so the DSO, you know, I think from my viewpoint is the DSO has come in and said, hey, we'll take those. I mean, I get these ads, we were just talking about earlier. I get these ads from some very large DSOs that you would know out there because they think I'm a dentist. And these ads say, you know, management relief. We provide management relief, management relief, management relief. And I've also noticed as well that there's a lot of outside money that is clamoring to get into the dental space in the form of private equity. Because what I have seen is that the dental practices, you know, most dental practices around the country, it's changing rapidly, but many are still very much fragmented and mom and pop kind of businesses, right? It's one you know, single owner doctor, right? And so there's a lot of money to be made to roll those together and maybe get 20 or 30 of those together. And then there are more private equity and larger DSO groups who would then buy those up. So it's almost like, I was thinking about it earlier, it's almost like a real estate boom, right? It's like this money is going into like Midtown Detroit, right? Or Memphis. And they're saying, hey, we can buy all this stuff up. We can rehab it, make it look nice and pretty. And then we can sell it off to some other investors who would, and then we make the difference between the middle. That's a kind of a crude way to explain it, but that's a little bit of what's happening, right? In the dental world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I would call it like the next gold rush in the respect if you think about it, because I think they finally figured out what dentists have known is that, like you talked about before, the good and the bad thing about a dental practice is that it's highly profitable if done right. Mm-hmm. And the reality is when private equity, the guys who have all the money guys, as we call them, they figure that stuff out. And just like Matt says, if they can come in there and they can actually change the game by coming in there and basically buying all these dental practices, putting them all together, it becomes a game of monopoly, because the real play becomes they buy it, like Matt was saying, maybe 20 of them come together. And what they do is they have smart guys who know how to manage these things, and they bring in dentist owners who come in there and run that as well. And then the next step is to basically go ahead and sell to the next big buyer. And so that has really changed the game of how dental practice, for lack of a better term, the buying and the selling market has changed dramatically. It used to be kind of a, like we talked about before, this cottage industry where you had a scenario where, like, just like Matt said, in the traditional methodology of you bring an associate aboard, they get mentored by the older doctor, they become a partner, and then you bring another doctor as an associate. Those days, I think, are really, I hate to say this, but they're gone, because the reality is that now it comes to a point where, like I just said from the very beginning of this discussion, the dentist coming out, all the young dentists coming out, they really don't. If you ask, I think, Matt, you might have told me this, that if you ask most guys in dental school if they want to own a practice, the majority of them don't want to own a practice anymore.
That's right. That's right. I was at a at the University of Tennessee meeting with some of their D3s and D4s. There's about 35 of them in the room. And I just asked them casually, hey, how many of you guys want to own your own practice? And out of 35, one raised their hand and said that he wanted to own his own practice. And again, a lot of them, I think they're scared. And again, like that debt load, they don't think they can get financing. And, you know, there's a lot of things that come in there, but they want to make a lot of money. We talk about that in another podcast, right? Yeah. They still want to make a lot of money. They just don't want to take that entrepreneurial risk to go and do it, you know? So, and I also think too, said that money is flowing and attracted to the dental marketplace because it's really one of the last places in healthcare that there is such a fragmented cottage world still out there, right? I mean, think about doctor's offices. Most doctors, it's a rare doctor who is in practice by him or herself. Most of the time they have multiple partners. They've already been kind of gobbled up by a group. Now, some of that's still happening at the larger levels. Some of these large, you know, 70, 80 partner practices are still getting gobbled up by private equity. And, you know, they're wanting to go public and do those big things. But in terms of in the dental world, I mean, DSOs or private equity can get into the dental space for $3 or $4 million and get 3 or 4 practices and turn that into 8 or 10 practices, 12, 15 practices, and then turn around and exit for an incredible, you know, return on their investment in a very relatively short period of time. Because the dental practice, as I have said, is like the speedboat of healthcare, right? You just turn that wheel just a little bit and boom, that dental practice can be off in a totally different direction. And like you said, these money guys know how to come in and do that and where to find the profits. Whereas a lot of medical practices these days are like, you know, cruise ships. It takes a lot for them to turn, and it takes a lot of money and effort. And so, you know, I don't know about you, but again, because I get advertised too, like I'm a dentist because our company's name is Dental Impact. You know, I'm just getting hit on Facebook, on Instagram, on LinkedIn all day long with these offers to, you know, check out this DSO or that DSO or check out our model. The upside, I guess, of a DSO, they're not all bad. If somebody's just kind of done and they want to get out and, you know, there are buyers out there for your practice. But what are some of the downsides that you've seen on some of the offers that you have seen yourself or have heard others have gotten?
Yeah, I think, you know, like to Matt's point, there is an advantage. I mean, for the doctor who simply does not want to own a practice anymore, they just burnt out, they just want to have someone take it over, there's certainly a distinct advantage for that. But the reality is that I think that's the challenge. I don't think these doctors truly know what they're getting into. I mean, as much as it sounds nice to have someone take over the management for you, and don't get me wrong, you have some very sophisticated, successful DSOs out there who know what they're doing. But it's difficult because you have to remember you're going from a scenario where you've run and own your practice and you have a certain vision and you have a certain way of actually how your patients are seen, how your staff is done, how your payroll is done. Suddenly that's all done. That's all gone. It's simply taken over. It's run into a particular larger organization system and methodology of how they do things. And that can be challenging in its own right to get used to. And the second thing is the autonomy. You literally give up the autonomy you want because you're no longer an owner at that particular time. Although, of course, you're going to get a nice, obviously, payoff in the beginning, which could be debatable how nice that payoff is. Because one of the biggest challenges, and I'll just go into it, and Matt, feel free to cut me off if I get too long-winded here. But when you get paid off, one of the challenges doctors have to remember is that you're not going to get all the money. You know, I think the challenge is that you have to realize there's one thing that always gets forgotten, capital gains tax, right? I mean, Matt can probably talk a bit more about that. But the reality is that you get paid out a bit of money, then suddenly you're paying capital gain tax because you're going to get this buyout from the DSO. So there goes a certain, I would say close to 30% would be taken straight off the top for that. And the other reality is that a lot of these DSOs do what's called holdbacks, meaning that they want to make sure that, okay, now that we've got you, are you still going to perform in the same manner, if not better, to make sure that we were actually paid you the value your practice truly was. And sometimes those agreements can be very onerous, meaning that they're going to set these kind of goals and kind of benchmarks, which have been much higher than that practice has ever done before. And then built within that agreement, if you don't hit that, they can actually not give you the money or turn around and then take the practice from you for basically pennies on the dollar because of the agreements they put together. So it can be very concerning unless you look at all the details regarding those buyouts, because I always tell doctors that, you know, devil's in the details, right? You have to look at what kind of agreement you're putting together. But more importantly, that's the stuff I always tell doctors about, is that selling out to a DSO could be a great relief, but it isn't like it's something where it's turnkey. There's a lot of moving parts to it. We can talk for, gosh, several podcasts and all the different intricacies about how we could deal with a certain deal. But that's the big picture. It's not turnkey. It's not easy. And in many respects, if you're looking at it as being a giant cash windfall, where you can kind of set it and forget it, that's not going to happen.
It's different than, like, say, buying a fixer-upper house and turning around and flipping it and just getting Absolutely. The cash and walking away, right?
Absolutely.
Or actually selling your house. Basically, I guess the analogy would be I'm selling my house that needs a lot of work. And I'm selling it for at a lower price to somebody who's going to go and do the work and then turn around and flip it. But the difference in that deal is I'm not getting the cash and able to just walk away and go live my life. There's an earnout period. There's a holdbacks. There are, you know, benchmarks that you have to hit, all of that kind of stuff. And we've heard, you and I both have heard and know some folks personally who have really had some really challenging situations happen after a deal was done that, you know, everybody celebrated. Hey, man, way to go. That's awesome. And then, you know, less than a year later, things are looking so good and they've had to write checks and buy that practice back, or, you know, the lawyers enforce those clauses, right?
They
absolutely enforce those clauses. So it's not the end all be all. Well, I think if folks have listened to our podcast, if you haven't listened, please go back and start at the beginning and listen through here. Our mission, what we want to be able to do is to tell you that there is another way, right, Sid? There can be another way. Let's talk about that for just a second as we end here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things, you can be your own, you don't have to like basically sell to a DSO. You don't have to get into a position where you feel that's your only options. I think you can use a lot of the same structures and disciplines and management styles that DSOs do. Like we've talked about in other podcasts, you can be better about managing your practice through being a better, efficient managerial style. We've talked many times about it. We've talked about how you can go about, you know, getting associate doctors aboard, how you can go about tracking your numbers better. You can go about being a better marketing company. There's a lot of different layers to it that they're already doing. You don't necessarily have to feel as if because they're larger and bigger, they'll be doing things that any strong business would do, that you can do the same type of processes like we talked about, you know, the ascension of Everest that we're talking about. You can do a lot of those things and act, and for lack of a better term, be a DSO yourself if you want. You don't necessarily have to be the size of the bigger ones that Matt's been talking about, but you can certainly act and manage a practice like that and do extremely well. And there's many different options. My option tends to be multiple associates. You know, I'm looking at potentially evolving into one that has some minority partnerships, but there's many different processes out there which you can bring partners aboard. You can actually create these kind of structures and management companies to allow yourself to grow in a way that can keep yourself insulated from environments where you have to feel as if you have to get all the options being bought out. So I would always challenge those who are kind of in that position where they're so burnt out. Maybe just change your mindset and look at like, well, maybe if you don't want to be in a chair all the time, let's talk about how we can structure your practice and your management style to actually accommodate your goals of basically getting out of the chair, still being profitable, creating a better business, and at the end of the day, creating a better future for yourself rather than one of relegation. So I think there's a ton of different options just by taking into account there are already some really great roadmaps out there. And we're glad to keep talking about that. But I think the biggest thing I want to dispel right off the bat is that the DSO has some kind of secret sauce. I mean, again, nothing wrong with what they are. I think they're wonderful organizations. And I think I want to dispel the myth that they're simply taking over. They're in the processes that any solo dentist can do. They can use that information. They can start to grow in the same capacities. It just takes some different skill sets and some different ways of learning how to manage your practice.
You know, I was thinking about our podcast today, and I've been thinking of a lot over the past little while about, you know, who are we talking to? Who is my guy or my gal that I really want to spend my time with? And listen, if you're a doctor who you're just done with management, you're done with trying to grow the practice, then DSO can be a great option for you. There are ways out of the chair. But if you've just got just a little bit in you, just a little bit of willingness and a little bit of fight left, then we can really help you. And there's folks out there, there's roadmaps out there to help you just understand what the guys who started these DSOs understand. They understand what makes the practice valuable. They understand economies of scale. All those things are very simple. It just takes a little time and effort to learn them. So it sounds like, said, why don't we spend the next podcast talking about what does increase the value of dental practices? Again, I've got a book coming out about this. We can talk about it. I'd love to get your thoughts on it and try to help some folks out and shift their mindset around. I'll give you a little kind of spoiler alert. It's not just profitability, right? It's not just production and profitability, right? It's the strategy. It is the machine. It's the operation, how it works in the back. So how does that sound to you?
That sounds good. That would be really valuable for folks. I agree.
All right. Great. Great, Sed. Well, thanks for listening, folks, today. Sed, thanks for being on the podcast with me. And we hope you guys have a great time. We'll see you soon. Thanks.
All right, guys. Talk soon.